Sam an alcoholic.
I'm RC.
And before it's all about me, I really want to thank Dan for asking me. Dan heard me speak at a Friday night meeting and asked me to speak, which always shocks and amazes me. My friend Michael, who reminded me to breathe, which I still don't do, and I'm okay with that. And to the two newcomers, the one thing that I know that I didn't know is that if I don't drink and use today, I will go to bed sober. And it's really that simple. You know, being in your first 30 days sucks, and I did it twice, and I hope to never have to do it again because I don't know that I could. So if you had told me 24 and a half years ago that I would be standing up here doing this, my first response would have been to beat the shit out of you. My favorite thing to do was to take a lot of Quaaludes and get in fist fights. And thank you. And I mean, to let you know, I'm 5'3". I was 105 pounds when I got sober. And my favorite thing to do was to find the biggest guy in the room and attempt to beat the shit out of him, because that made sense to me. That kind of pain was a pain I could understand, and the pain that I felt normally, I didn't get it. I want to also acknowledge my friends sitting in the front row, Michael, who came with me, Carlos, and who spoke last night, and Jason, you know, who I've known for all of them for a very, very long time, and Michael came with me, you know what I mean? Like, that's still somewhat shocking to me that he knows me, and yet here he is, and, you know, and there's a reason for that, because the other thing that went along with the Quaaludes and the fist fighting was my other favorite thing to do was to find really big people and try and make them cry. And they will tell you, they can confirm this after the meeting, I was mean. And I still can be, but I was mean. And I thought that if I thought it, it was really important that you hear it. Really important. Because it was the most important thought ever. And if you just listened, if you just listened, your life would change. You know, and really, just a lot of bad behavior. I started drinking when I was 4 years old. My dad thought it was really cute. Daddy, can I have a sip of your beer? Sure, honey. And he worked at a clothing store or a clothing company, and he'd bring me home cute little dresses. And I had this fabulous 60s wardrobe, and we had fabulous 60s cocktail parties. And, you know, I love to mix drinks. Starting when I was 4 or 5, 6 years old, he had this rolling bar cart that kind of looked like this podium, and it opened up, and there were all these cute little crystal glasses inside and the liquor on top, and I would make drinks, and I'd hand the drinks to the adults, and they would take one sip and go, whoa, honey, you need to, like, tone that down, and this is at 5 years old. And the reason I did that is because you wouldn't be able to finish it, and if you couldn't finish it, well, I would have to take the glass to the kitchen, and if some of it just fell down my throat on the way to the kitchen, oh, well. You know, in my house, my parents, you know, they tried really hard and they gave me every advantage in the world, but they're actually just lunatics. And, you know, every night my mom loved to scream at my dad because daddy just didn't make enough money to support mommy in the style to which she thought she was accustomed, which she never was. And, you know, they would have screaming fights and she liked to throw things at the wall and break things. And this was my bedtime music, was mommy screaming at daddy and throwing things. And my brother slept, you know, my brother slept through all of it. And if you talk to him, it's like we were raised in two different houses. And I went to bed in fear and I woke up in fear. And my solution was to take this brother of mine who's 2 years younger than I am. And until he was 15 years old, significantly smaller than I was, and beat him up because he was there. And, you know, the day he turned 15, we were the exact same size, and I made the mistake of hitting him, and he flattened me, and never hit him since. And, so I started drinking when I was 4. I started smoking when I was 6. When I was 11, I discovered pot. When I was 14, I discovered Quaaludes. When I was 15, I was taking 15 to 20 a day. And functioning. I mean, going to school, I had a job, and it all always looked good on the outside. I don't know how, I don't know why, but it just looked like I had it together. So this is one of my what it was like places, this hotel. Dan sent me the information, and I'm looking at it going, why do I know the name of this hotel? And then I looked, and there used to be a restaurant here called Ben Brown's, and that reminded me that 27, 28 years ago, my girlfriend and my best friend and I used to rent a room here, and every time, you know, we came down 3 or 4 times, and every time we came down, we're going to go to the beach this time. This time it's going to be different, and we're going to get to that beach. And, you know, and what we would do is we would stay in the room for 3 or 4 days, and we'd shoot crystal, because by the time I was done, yay, I could. Thank you. because it was the 80s, and by the time I was done, I had put so much in my nose that no more would go in there. And, you know, needles were a great idea, aren't they? They're a fabulous idea, you know. You won't go in one hole, find another. And if you don't have another, make another, right? Is that the most genius thing you've ever heard? And that was, like, my series of really good ideas. We're always just like that. You know, there is a solution to every problem. And the problem is, I can't get any more powder in my nose. Great, I'll stick it in a vein. Very creative, I thought. You know, I when I can't get drugs, I drink. When I, you know, when there isn't alcohol, I can get drugs. I started going to clubs at 14. I looked like I was 9. I sounded like I was 30. And I could, you know, would flash my bag of Quaaludes, and they would get me in any club without ID. I didn't have my first fake ID, actually, till I was 20. And I didn't get carded until then. And it was back in the day when the driver's licenses were, like, that plastic-coated and... So this girl that was actually the first girl I ever went on a date with, she had washed it, and she was 5'11", and so it was kind of washed and funky, and so I picked off the one that made it 11, and so it looked like it said 5'1", which is around my size. And, you know, and she kind of had, you know, longish brown hair, and I would just flash it, and I'd flash my bag of Quaaludes in the other hand and get in. And, you know, I loved going to clubs. I actually, 2 years into my sobriety, every Friday and Saturday night, that's what we did. We went to a meeting, we went to dinner, we went to a club. Or, you know, if there was a big movie, we'd go to the movie. But I loved my drugs. I loved my alcohol. I loved the way they made me feel until they stopped working, you know, and they stopped. They worked for a really long time. Like, I'd heard people talk about how they got high once and then they chased that high for years. I got high once and then I got high again and again and again. And it worked for a really long time. And then it didn't, you know, and that was... That sucked. I was 21 years old, and I mean, I was so high that I didn't know I was gay. Like, I had no idea. So, you know, I was fucking all these guys, and I actually almost married one of them, and I couldn't figure out, like, why I didn't like it until one day a guy told me that the girl liked me. And I'm standing in the middle of my job at Gelson's in the cookie and cracker aisle going, oh, I like her too. That must be the problem. I mean, this is how out of it I have been for, you know, I'm 19 years old at this point, and just like, oh, you know, because it just never occurred to me that that was a possibility or an option. I found my first girlfriend on my 21st birthday. It was just a crazy, violent relationship. Because I was all about violence, and so was she. She was a drunk, and she was a messy drunk. She was one of those drunks who would, like, drink and get angry and then go out in the parking lot of whatever club we were at and try and break somebody's windshield with her fist. And I just thought that was so tacky. I'm like, girl, that's just too much work. You know, punch someone, get it over with, but to sit here and, like, smash a window over and over again and then never be able to break it? Like, she never once actually broke a window. fucked up her hand good, but never really broke a window. And I just, you know, was like, honey, take a pill. Take one of these. That'll fix it. And, you know, and I came home from work one day, and she and my best friend were up to something. Like, I got home, it was about 10:30 at night, and they had been doing something, and they just were not going to tell me what it was. And I told them both. I said, you tell me now, or I'm going to take your heads, and I'm going to smash them together. You know, and again, they outweigh me by a good couple hundred pounds. I mean, you know, they're not huge people, but they're definitely bigger than I was. And, you know, terrified of me, because that's how I liked it. If you were in my life, you had to know fear, and you had to know it because I put it in you. And, you know, they finally told me, and what they had done that night for the first time was they shot up, and I was like, I'm in, and I'm really pissed at you for not telling me. And, you know, we did that for a few years, and I'm, you know, still with this girl, and it's still all violence, all crazy, all the time, and lots of sex with other people in our relationship, and, you know, and she didn't really like that, but I kind of did, and so too bad for her, and, you know, and one of the things that I'd been told my whole life that was that I was going to go to college. I mean, that was just not optional not to go. So I'm just wasted, and I go to Santa Monica College, and I'm taking these classes, and my English teacher walks into class one day, and he says, we're offering a semester abroad program for English majors, which is what I was, and that voice of God that is not my voice just said, you're going. And my hand, you know, when he said, who wants to go, my hand went up in the air, and that was not me putting my hand up in the air. You know, I couldn't fathom leaving. You know, just leaving LA, leaving everything I knew, leaving my parents, leaving. I couldn't do that. And God did that for me. And I knew that if I didn't go on this trip, that this girl and I would continue to shoot up and one of us was going to die from it. And so I went on this trip, and, you know, I was going to come back and we were going to live happily ever after, and she was going to stop shooting up while I was gone, and so was I. And so I get there, and one of the teachers had been a member of this program for 3 years. And he got there 10 days before we did, and while he was there for those 10 days, he started drinking again. And he was, there were 25 of us on this trip, and he was absolutely determined to teach every single one of us how to drink, even if he taught us nothing else. And he took us to pubs. We actually had classrooms in a gym, and in England, in the gyms, they have pubs in the gyms, which was awesome. So, you know, at our break, we would go to the pub and we would all drink, including the two teachers. And, we went on all these different little side trips and he was there. And, you know, I mean, on one of these trips with this 50 something year old man who's supposed to be teaching us little pukey kids, he has us all laid down on the sidewalk to look at the moon. In this little town in the middle of England, in the middle of nowhere, and all these like British people are walking by going, what the fuck's wrong with these Americans? And I just thought it was the coolest thing. Like, look at us. We're total freaks. And so I came home from this trip to find out that this girlfriend number one had left me 10 days before I got home. And that was at the beginning of June. We basically continued to see each other that whole summer, and by September, the girl she'd left me for had figured out that she was still seeing me, and she called me up and said, well, we need to talk. And that was on Labor Day weekend, and by the end of that, we tricked girl number one into coming over to girl number two's house, and by the end of the weekend, girl number two and I were together, and we had both dumped girl number one. And girl number two lived in this really cute house in this really cute neighborhood, and she had this bay window in the front that didn't have a curtain on it. And girl number one was so pissed about what we did to her that she would park across the street, and she would sit there for hours and hours and hours at a time in her very distinct car, and we would see her through the window because there were no curtains. And she would just sit there all night and just stare and see if we would, like, walk by the window. Yeah. So, you know, 15 months go by and girl number two leaves me and I know I'm going to die. And at this point, I've stopped doing all drugs. Like, actually, pretty much after I got back from this trip, I'd stopped doing all drugs and now I'm just drinking. And by the time I'm done drinking, just kind of like I took Quaaludes and just like I shot Crystal, I'm drinking a 1.75 liter bottle of vodka in one sitting, getting up and walking away. You know, I'm at UCLA at this point, reading all these dead white men stories and, you know, passing my classes, and I have a job. When I got back from England, I got a job at the American Foundation for AIDS Research. And actually, the first few months that I was working there, girl number one and I, while we're cheating on girl number two, are still shooting Crystal in the stairwell. So, like, I'm working at an AIDS research place, like, shooting Crystal in the stairwell, knowing fully well, you know, because they're like, you know. And so I get back from, like, these Crystal binges in the stairwell, and we'd have to do these mass mailings. And I would sit in there, and I would stuffed more envelopes than all the other people there combined.
Really?
Because I was really good at it. I could stuff a lot of envelopes. And everybody there was fucked up. Like, the CFO would come out of his office, like, with a tissue, trying to get all the powder off his nose, because it wasn't going up his nose either. And the head of development would, like, stagger around drunk. And the research guy would go into these, like, crazy rages where he'd take everything in his office and start throwing it out the door of his office into, like, the main room of the place. It was awesome. Like, it was the coolest job. And we'd have these, like, really great events where we'd get all this free alcohol, and by the end of the night, like, everyone that worked there was practically under the table. So I'm working at this place. I'm shooting crystal. I finally realized, you know, girl, you need to stop doing that because it's not pretty. And I just start drinking, and I'm drinking a lot. And I'm going to work, and after about a year and a half of working there, they hired 3 people all at the same time, and they were all sober. And they did what we do, and they would get together at lunch, and they would talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, and they would talk about how to change their lives, and they would talk about their problems, and they would talk about solutions, and they would talk about the book and the steps. And I'd just look at them and go, what the fuck is wrong with you people? Like, you're members of a cult, and you should just be able to work it out on your own. And they would just look at me and go, okay, honey. And, you know, I was coming into work just with alcohol coming out of my pores, like, green in color, just fucked up from the night before, and they knew it. And, you know, arguing my point because, again, I knew everything, and I had all the solutions. And one of them, you know, 2 were guys and 1 was a woman, and this is a program of attraction. She was so attractive, and she still is. She just turned 30 in September, and she's still really hot. But anyways, so girlfriend number 2 leaves me, and I'm really fucked up, so I decide to go to therapy, and both my therapist and this woman I work with are now saying to me, you know, do you think you have a problem with drugs and alcohol? And I've known since I was 14 years old that I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic, but it's something that I'm proud of. It's part of who I am. It's what I'm known for. And, you know, I'm telling them, no, that's not the problem. The problem is you. And if I can just get you to do things the way I need you to do things, everything will be okay. And it's not the drinking and it's not the drugs that are causing my problem. It's that you are not doing things the way I need you to. It's that girlfriend number 2 won't take me back. So in the meantime, I move on to girlfriend number 3. And, you know, we've been going out for 4 or 5 months. And girlfriend number 2 calls me and says, you know, I'm not really liking the girl I'm with, and I'm thinking about leaving her and getting back together with you. And I look at girlfriend number 3, and I'm like, oh, she might want me back. And girlfriend number 3 clearly does not appreciate this as much as I do. And a week later, girlfriend number 2 calls me back and says, no, I think I'm going to stay with the girl I'm with. Never mind. I don't want to get back together with you. And, I left out the part where, so I'm going to work. The girl I work with, you know, is asking me all the time, like, are you, you know, do you want to get sober? Do you want to be sober? And then again, that voice of God that took me on that trip to England said, yes. And we both kind of looked at me like, who said that? And it was me. And she said, well, can you go the rest of the day without getting high? And she took me to my first meeting. So when girlfriend number 2 called me and said, I don't want to be with you, I was actually 52 days sober. And I looked at girlfriend number 3 and I said, I'm going to drink. And she said, no, you're not. And I said, yes, I am. And of course, I walked a block and a half to the liquor store, I bought a pint of vodka. I drank the whole thing on the way home. By the time I, you know, walked in my house, I was drunk as fuck. And girlfriend number 3 starts sobbing, slaps my face, and leaves. At noon on that day, I had therapy. And my therapist, you know, I'm sitting there, like, with one hand over one eye to only see one of her. And she's huge. This woman is so big, and one of her is plenty. So I'm, like, 40 minutes in her chair praying, God, please don't let me pee in this woman's chair. And she basically spends my 45 minutes crying because I'm clearly drunk. Like, I'm now well into my second pint, and it's barely noon. And she spends, like, my whole time crying. And I'm like, bitch, please. Like, it's my turn. Like, why are you crying? And she, yeah, it was not good. So then I left. And then later that afternoon, a girl who 13-stepped me came over, And she was sober like a year and a half, and she didn't care that I was drunk. But in the middle of fooling around with her, something came on TV that caught my attention, and I stopped fooling around with her and started watching TV. She did not appreciate that in the least. She slapped my face and left. And that was September 21st, 1988, and that was my last day drinking. And I can tell, you know, the whole day consisted of me making people cry. You know, and that was many, 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 many days before that. Like, my whole life was about making people cry and doing what I wanted and not thinking about you and not thinking about how what I did would affect you in any way, because it didn't matter. You know, what mattered was you doing it my way. And if you did it my way, life would be a beautiful place for you and especially for me. So I get sober. And I do not like it. I am not one of those people that walked in here and went, "Eh, I'm home." I came in this room and went, "What the fuck are you people talking about?" The first meeting I remember, speaker question, and I thought the questions, I'm like, how do you not know the answer to that? And what does the question mean anyway? Like, I just thought it was stupid. And then the second meeting I remember, this woman named Yvette, who, I don't know, was sober forever and was mean. She was meaner than I was. And I knew not to say anything, was like, "You're going to be washing ashtrays." And I was like, "I'm going to be what? Like, don't you know my mother raised me to hire a maid? I don't wash people's ashtrays." You know, and all this is going through my head. Because it's true. My mother did raise me to hire maids because she has delusions of grandeur. And, you know, we don't clean. We hire people to clean. And it's like, you know, I clean today. Not for a living. But, you know, I clean my own shit. So anyways, I couldn't say anything to Yvette because she would have knocked me down. And so I cleaned ashtrays. And I did it anyway, you know. And then somebody else was like, "Well, you need to do this." And I'm like, "What?" Oh, someone said I needed to stand at the door and shake people's hands. So I got sober, you know, September 21st. It's still kind of hot out because it's L.A. And the first person shook my hand, it was all sweaty. And I'm like, "Oh, no." And I'm not like a germ freak or anything, but that was fucked up. That was like slime on my hand. And then there were like all these people coming in the room, and I'm like, "Fuck, how am I going to do this? And my hand is just going to be like gross." And I'm a nail biter, you know what I mean? I'm still a nail biter. And so I'm like, "This is not right. These people are just wrong." And yeah, it was not good. So, I mean, this is how I thought for a long time into sobriety. Like, I can't, like at least 5 years into sobriety, this was my thinking. Like, no matter what it was you said, my thought was, "Fuck that." And, you know, and when I was new, that was the answer you got. Like, "Do this? Fuck you." You know, unless, you know, you were big and scary like Yvette. But to most people, that was my response. And then I'd kind of just show up and do it anyway. So, and then now what I've learned is that I can think that all I want, but that my thoughts are no longer the most important thing in the world, and that if I think it, generally, I shouldn't say it out loud. You know, that my job today is not to make you cry. My job today is to help you live through, you know, the shit that is life. I needed I was new, and I needed a sponsor, and I went to this big, giant Wednesday night meeting. I mean, this meeting was big. It was in this little, tiny room. People would sit on each other's laps. People would sit on the floor in the aisle, and I needed a sponsor because this woman that I worked with was like, "I'm not, you know," I'd go in her office every day, and I'd still talk about you and how I needed you to change and how I needed you to be different, and she would give me the big book to read. And the first time I read the big book, so I'm at UCLA at this point, like I said, I'm an English major, I'm minoring in women's studies and, you know, women with a Y, and she gives me the big book to read, and it talks about God with a capital G, and it refers to God as a him, and I read one paragraph of this book, and I hand the book back to her, and I can't read this. This is too misogynistic. And so, I mean, I literally said this to her, and she just looks at me like, "What?" And so she took a pencil, and she still has this book because I ask her about it occasionally, and she crossed out all the gods and wrote goddess, and crossed out all the hymns and wrote her, and handed me back the book and said, "Now read it, asshole." And And, you know, that's what I could hear. I was not someone who could hear, oh, honey, that's okay. You'll get to it when you get to it. Because if I waited till I could get to it, I would not be your speaker tonight. I would be dead. I would be, like, my ashes would be scattered wherever, you know, the funeral home scattered them, because it wouldn't be my family showing up. So I asked this woman to sponsor me, who is secretary of this Wednesday night meeting, and I hate this woman. She gets up every week to share. Hi, my name is, and I swear to God, never gets past that. She starts sobbing. And I barely know this woman's name. Like, she's never shared a word besides, hi, my name is, and just hysterically crying from the podium. And I'm like, the fuck is wrong with this woman? But, you know, I asked her to sponsor me, because what happened at the end of that meeting, every night, and I watched this, like, it took me till I was 6 months sober to ask her to sponsor me. Every time she got up to do that, which I swear to God was almost every week for 6 months, she had a crowd of people around her at the end of that meeting. And I, you know, stand off to the side, like, listening, and, oh, honey, we love you, and it's going to be okay. And I'm like, what? And, you know, in my life at this point, I'm now 6 months sober. And so at 9 months sober, one of my really good friends got in a horrible motorcycle accident, was in the hospital for a week, and they turned off her life support and died. And at 9 months of sobriety, the woman who was supposed to be my best friend looked, you know, when I looked to her for comfort, said, you know, you have friends, call one. You know, and that was my best friend. Like, that's how my best friend was talking to me. Because at this point, you know, I'm sober, I'm dry, and I'm even meaner than I was on drugs and alcohol, which I didn't even think that was possible, but apparently it was. You know, and I have no people in my life, and I don't know how to get people in my life, and this woman clearly does. And it involves standing at a podium and sobbing every week. Like, I'm not up for that, but maybe she has another way of me learning how to get people back in my life without them being hostages. And, you know, because that's all I knew. That's all I knew how to do. And so she, we start reading the book and we start working the steps, and, you know, I get to that fourth step, and I wrote a fourth step that, you know, had my first column, which was what you did. And, or I'm sorry, the first column was who did it, and the second column is what you did, and the third column is how it affects my various things. And, you know, that second column was huge. That second column was big. That second column went on and on and on and on, because, God damn, you did a lot of stuff to me. You know, a lot of stuff, a lot of horrible stuff you did to me. And that fourth column, which is supposed to be me looking at what I did to you, where was I selfish, self-seeking, frightened, and dishonest, or dishonest and frightened, that thing was skinny. That thing was as skinny as I wish I was today. You know, that thing was thin. And, you know, she didn't really say anything about it. And I go through sponsors, you know, again, relationships with people. I'm still at 24 and a half years sober. I'm not great at it. And I think I'm on sponsor 19, though I think he was sponsor 15 also. So, you know, I got to sponsor number 3, and I wrote my third fourth step, and I'm you know, 2 years sober at this point, and I'm on sponsor number 3, and I showed her that same thing where that second column is big and it's huge, and you're still doing horrible things to me, and oh my God, and my parents are still fucked, and you know, everybody's just fucked. And I get to that fourth column, and she just looks at it, and she's like, "What is that?" And I said, "That's my fourth column." And she's like, "Oh, no, it's not." And she, you know, I read her the resentment, and then she, I don't know how she did this. It was like magic, and it was the most fucked up thing ever. She's like, "And you did this, and you did that, and you did this." And she's talking about all this stuff that I did. And I'm like, well, how does she know that? You know, how does she know what I did? How does she know what I did to these people? Like, who told her? Like, which one of you fuckers told her? Like, I'm going to beat them up. Like, I'm going to kill them. And, you know, I said, how do you know that? Like, I'm freaking out. Like, I'm sweating, and I'm going to barf all over her, and it is not good. Like, I'm going to pass out from this because I am just completely freaking out. And, you know, what she told me was, she said, I know all this because I did it. She said, I know all this because I was you. I know all this because I thought I knew everything, too. You know, and it wasn't magic, and it wasn't craziness, and no one told her anything. She just knew because she was me. You know, that first step, for whatever reason, with the first step, I had been able to come, except for one day, you know, I had been able to come to meetings for 24 and a half years and listen to you and not think that it's a good idea. You know, I've had a lot of great ideas in sobriety, but drinking has never been one of them. Not that I haven't wanted to, I just haven't gone through with it. Like, you know, God, let me make it to the time I go to bed today, and if I still want to drink tomorrow, then I'll get up tomorrow and drink. And you know what? I've never gotten up the next day and had to take that drink. If I can make it through today, I've never needed that drink tomorrow. The second step, what I've learned, and I've just learned it recently, is that the being restored to sanity isn't that I'm going to get well. Because if you listen to me clearly, I am not well. But that I no longer think that if I drink, it's going to be different. It is not going to be different. It's going to be exactly the same. It's going to involve me being completely depressed and you crying. And I get that. I get that clear as day. It is not going to change a single fact of my life. It's not going to change the fact that I haven't been on a third date in 7 years, and y'all know what happens on that third date. It's not going to change the fact that I, you know, that I don't have certain things in my life that I think I need. You know, I don't need those things because if I needed them, I would have them. You know, it's just not going to change anything. You know, the third step for me is what make that hill green. You know, and it's not you. You didn't go out there and plant that. You didn't go out there and make those rocks happen. And there's something that did, and it's not you. And that's the best I can explain it. I've done a lot of four steps in sobriety because I've had to, because I behaved very, very badly in sobriety. And so have you, frankly. And so I need to do those four steps, and I need to keep doing those four steps. And I love them. I love them because they give me a freedom for me that I didn't have before. And how I get there is I look at my character defects, which, you know, as the three men in the front row can tell you, are still there, but they are a lot lighter than they were. You know, I've known Michael and Carlos for 21 years, and Michael and I hated each other. Hated. He would sit in the front with his friends at meetings, and they would talk through the entire meeting. And I would walk up to them and go, you know, if you bother to listen to a speaker, you might stay sober. Like, that was my thought, and he needed to hear it. And so did his friends. And they were like, you know, I'd walk away. That fucking bitch, what the fuck does she think she is? You know, and then I moved a lot in sobriety, and his sponsor forced him to show up to one of my moves, and he was, like, cussing the whole time. I didn't know that. And, you know, he is one of those people today that no matter what is going on, if I call him up and say, Michael, I need you. I love to hike. The hiking is one of my favorite things in the world. And I got to the top of Griffith Park, and again, that voice of God said, where's your key? And I reach in this, like, crazy thing I wear that has my water bottles on it and a little fanny pack thing in the back, and I reach back in there, and my car key is not there. And I have hiked an hour to get to the top of this mountain, and I'm like, oh, shit. So I run down the mountain, and he called me, like, just happened in that brief 5 minute period of time when I'm like, oh my God, where's my key? He called me up and I'm like, Michael, I'm at the top of the mountain in Griffith Park and I can't find my car key. And he's like, he paused for a second. He's like, well, I'll come and get you. So I run down the mountain and I'm looking for this key and I can't find it. And I call him back. I'm like, oh my God, Michael, I can't find my key. He picked me up. He took me to a meeting. He took me out to Encino to my brother's house to get the key, and he took me back to my car. I mean, it took, like, the whole day to do all that stuff, you know? And Michael's a guy now that I can call and do that with, and this was a man who hated me because I was mean, and he had every reason to. So I look at my character defects today, and to be a person without them, you know, I have to look at them, and I have to acknowledge them. What got my behavior to change more than anything was that ninth step, and how it was explained to me to do it was to make that list in the eighth step, and my sponsor had me split that list into three sections. The first that were easy to do, the second that were hard, and the third section of it, the ones that were absolutely impossible, and I was never going to be able to do them. And, you know, some of those included members of my family. You know, the first 10 years of my life, I had the most awesome dad in the world, and the middle 20 years, he sucked. And the last 10 years, he was the greatest dad in the world. And it wasn't because he changed. It was because I did. he was on that impossible list. So I got through the easy part, and when I got through the easy part, I realized that it wasn't going to kill me. So when I got to the hard part, I could do them. And then when I got through the hard part, the impossible ones were doable. But standing in front of you and having to say I was wrong and what can I do to make this right, like that sucks worse than most things in life. And so in order to not have to do that, I try not to behave badly. Like last week at work, and am I perfect at it? Not even close. Last week at work, I was talking to this man, and he really pissed me off, and I was really overtired and really stressed out. And, you know, I needed to comment on the size of his penis. And it clearly not an appropriate thing to talk about with someone you don't know that well. And I went to him the next day, and I said, you know, John, that was totally unacceptable, and I was wrong, you know, and I don't like to do that. I just don't like to. So at 3 years of sobriety, and my friends are like, don't talk about this, but I talk about it. At 3 years of sobriety, I met her. She was a circuit speaker. She had 12 years more sober than I did. She was 12 years older than I am, and great speaker, one of the best speakers you could ever hope to hear. Would stand at the podium, could change your life from the podium, and if you were lucky enough to get to work with her one-on-one, literally your life would change. But she left out one important part, and that she is a wife beater. And, you know, my behavior was still bad, and my shame was still great. And the reason I've done a lot of four steps is because I had a lot of shame and a lot of guilt, and you know, and I stayed with this wife beater for 5 years in sobriety. So when I'm here to tell you that you can stay sober no matter what, I'm not lying. You know, I've stayed sober through the death of my dad, who I became really, really close to, through the end of relationships, not just that one, but others. I've stayed sober through the loss of homes. I was homeless in sobriety, carless in sobriety. Could you imagine at 3 years sober having to ride the bus in L.A.? Oh. And I hadn't ridden the bus since I was 15. Like, that just was wrong. Wrong. Let me just say that. You know, and the other thing I left out is I was 25 years old when I got sober. And, you know, and I was done. I was done, and I'm still done. And I thank God every day that I'm done. So I was with this wife beater, and, you know, everybody in my life was like just, you know, we'd break up constantly. And that's why that's why I was moving all the time. Because, like, we'd get together, and we'd stay together for, like, a minute, and then she'd be like, fuck you, get the fuck out. And then I'd have to move out. And so I'm always, like, calling people, you know, for these AA moves, like, I need help moving. Phoebe threw me out again. And, well, whatever. Anyways. I forgot to number her. Anyways, you know, and so one day you know, and I'm praying, 5 years of me praying, God, how do I not do this anymore? And it took me 5 years to figure it out. And that was so easy. Once I figured it out, and that was to look at her and just to say, you know what? I'm done. And from that day, we never got back together because I'd never said that before. I'd never said, you know, I'm done. Right? So I went to college. I graduated college with 87 days of sobriety. And I, you know, I lied and cheated my way through school and managed to get that degree, like, you know, like a good alcoholic. And I went to school because I wanted to be a teacher. And I knew when I got sober that that was not going to work, that I was not okay around kids. I was not safe around kids. And that if I attempted to do it, I was just going to end up getting fired, like, quickly. So, every year I would get this, I would call the school district and I would get the application and I would fill it out and I'd put it on the shelf. And 6 months later I'd go through my house because I'm always cleaning my house and I'd look at it and go, fuck it, and I'd throw it out. This went on for 13 years. And at 13 years of sobriety, I had a job that I loved and a boss who I hated so much that I was like, you know, let's just see what happens. And I was much safer to be around. I was much less abusive. I'd been around kids. Actually, to get out of that relationship with the wife beater, I'd moved to Hawaii. She, of course, then followed me there. My sponsor had a granddaughter and actually taught me how to be around kids, you know, and they would call me up and that kid would be screaming with, like, ear infections and four adults in the house, and they were like, oh, God, we can't take this anymore. And they would call me up and say, please come over and take the kid. And I can handle screaming kids. Like, it doesn't bother me. So I finally turned in that application, and they hired me. Because, at that point, I had reference letters. I had a job history. I had good credit. And they hired me. And it's 12 years later, and I still teach. I teach high school. And I swear to God, every day, a room full of you walk in, only untreated you walk in. And I treat them like they're newcomers. And I expect that they will treat each other with dignity and respect. And they will treat me with dignity and respect. And sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. And, and I have big kids, like, come up to me and, fuck you, and, they won't ever say it to my face. They'll, like, say it on their way out the door, or they'll, like, throw books, or, I've had a kid throw a chair, not at me, but, just throw them, and, and I handle it. I handle it. Like, I had a kid walk in 3 weeks ago who was so high that he reeked so bad that my whole room was like, it smelled like a pot farm in there. And, I'm like, Sammy, you really need to, like, spray yourself down before you come in the room. Or you need to better put your stash in a better container. And they just look at me like, Miss, how do you, and they call me Miss. Yeah, okay. All day. Miss. And they're like, how do you know that? Like, what are you saying? Like, they don't even get that someone my age can know, like, what they're up to. And, they just think that I am so not cool because I want them to come to class on time. So Sammy's so high and smells so bad that, like, my next class comes in and they're like, Miss, your class kind of smells like weed. I'm like, yeah, I know. Go talk to Sammy. And, and they look at me like, oh my God, and Sammy has this horrible life, and there's no point in calling his dad, and there's no point in turning him in because he is clearly not ready. And I get it. So, life in sobriety has been a blast. Like, I'm here, it's cute. Like, I have this, like, free little vacation weekend, and I get to spend it with friends, and it's amazing to me. I have a cute little apartment, I have a cute little car, like, I have some stuff. I don't have that because AA promised me that. I have that because I work for it, because I show up every day, because I do my job. Like, I actually get there on time, and I actually stay until I'm supposed to leave, and I actually teach my little kids who have no interest in learning anything at all. And they give me a paycheck every month, and with that paycheck I get every month, I'm able to, do the things that I like to do. Can I do everything? Of course not. But it's not because I'm owed any of that, because I'm not. AA doesn't promise me anything except that today I will be sober. And that if I'm sober today, I have a chance for something better tomorrow. So again, I know nothing except that I didn't drink and I didn't use today, and I had an awesome day. So thank you.
Let's give Marcy.